Dorian knew he was hurting him. Knew it, and didn't quite care.
Because you want to be Adian's king someday?
Kaol's face drained of color. From the cold or from fear, and Adian barked a laugh. My queen will die heirless sooner than marry a man from Otterlin. Kaol tried to hide his flicker of pain, but Dorian knew his friend well enough to spot it. For a second, he wondered what Selena would think about Adian's claim. Selena, who had lied. Selena, who was Aelin, whom he had met 10 years ago, whom he had played with in her beautiful castle. In that day in Endovir, that first day, he had felt as if there were something familiar about her. Oh, gods. Selena was Aelin Galathinius. He had danced with her, kissed her, slept beside her, his mortal enemy. I'll come back for you, she'd said her final day here. Even then, he'd known there was something else behind it. She would come back, but perhaps not as Selena. Would it be to help him, or to kill him? Aelin Galathinius knew about his magic, and wanted to destroy his father, his kingdom, everything she had ever said or done. He'd once thought it had been a charade to win his favor as champion. But what if it had been because she was the heir of Terrasen? Was that why she was friends with Nehemia? What if, after a year in Endovir, Aelin Galathinius had spent a year in that labor camp? A queen of their continent had been a slave, and would bear the scars of it forever. Perhaps that entitled her, and Adian, and even Kaol, who loved her, to conspire to deceive and betray his father.
Dorian, please, Kaol said. I'm doing this for you. I swear it.
I don't care,
Dorian said, staring them down as he walked out.
I will carry your secrets to the grave, but I want no part of them.
He ripped his cold magic from the air and turned it inward, wrapping it around his heart. Adian took the secret subterranean exit out of the castle. He'd told Kaol it was to avoid any suspicion, to lose anyone else trailing them as they went back to their rooms. One look from the captain told him he knew precisely where Adian was headed. Adian contemplated what the captain had told him, and though any other man would be horrified, though Adian should be horrified, he wasn't surprised. He'd suspected the king was wielding some sort of deadly power from the moment he'd given him that ring all those years ago, and it seemed in line with information his spies had long been gathering. The Yellowlegs matron had been here for a reason. Adian was willing to bet good money that whatever monstrosities or weapons the king was creating, they would see them soon enough, perhaps with the witches in tow. Men didn't build more armies and forge more weapons without having plans to use them, and they certainly didn't hand out bits of mind-controlling jewelry unless they wanted absolute dominion. But he would face what was coming just as he had every other trial in his life. Precisely, unyieldingly, and with lethal efficiency. He spotted the two figures waiting in the shadows of a ramshackle building by the docks, the fog off the Avery making them little more than wisps of darkness.
Well?
Wren demanded, as Adian leaned against a damp brick wall. Wren's twin swords were out. Good Otterlanian steel, nicked and scratched enough to show they'd been used, and well-oiled enough to show Wren knew how to care for them. They seemed to be the only things Wren cared about. His hair was shaggy, and his clothes looked a bit worse for wear.
I already told you. We can trust the captain.
Adian looked at Murtaugh.
Hello, old man.
He couldn't see Murtaugh's face beneath the shadows of his hood, but his voice was too soft as he said,
I hope the information is worth the risks you are taking.
Adian snarled. He wouldn't tell them the truth about Aelin, not until she was back at his side and could tell them herself. Ren took a step closer. He moved with the self-assurance of someone who was used to fighting and winning. Still, Adian had at least 3 inches and 20 pounds of muscle on him. Should Ren attack, he'd find himself on his ass in a heartbeat.
"I don't know what game you're playing, Adian," Ren said, "but if you don't tell us where she is, how can we trust you? And how does the captain know? Does the king have her?"
"No," Adian said. It wasn't a lie, but it felt like one. As Selena, she'd signed her soul to him.
"The way I see it, Ren, you and your grandfather have little to offer me, or Aelin. You don't have a warband, you don't have lands, and the captain told me all about your affiliation with that piece of shit Archer Finn. Do I need to remind you what happened to Nehemia Yitgur on your watch? So I'm not going to tell you. You'll receive information on a need-to-know basis."
Ren started. Murtaugh put an arm between them.
"It's better we don't know, just in case."
Ren wouldn't back down, and Adian's blood raced at the challenge.
"What are we going to tell the court, then?"
Ren demanded.
"That she's not some imposter as we were led to believe, but actually alive, yet you won't tell us where?"
"Yes," Adian breathed, wondering just how badly he could bloody up Ren without hurting Murtaugh in the process.
"That's exactly what you'll tell them. If you can even find the court."
Silence. Murtaugh said,
"We know Ravi and Sol are still alive and in Surya."
Adian knew the story. Their family's trade business had been too important to the king to warrant executing both their parents. So their father had chosen the execution block, and their mother had been left to keep Surya running as a vital trade port. The 2 Surian boys would be 20 and 22 by now, and since his mother's death, Sol had become lord of Surya. In his years leading the Bane, Adian had never set foot in the coastal city. He didn't want to know if they'd damn him.
Otterlin's whore.
"Will they fight?"
Adian said. "Or will they decide they like their gold too much?" Murtaugh sighed.
"I've heard Ravi is the wilder one. He might be the one to convince."
"I don't want anyone that we have to convince to join us," Adian said.
"You'll want people who aren't afraid of Aelin, or you,"
Murtaugh snapped.
"You'll want level-headed people who won't hesitate to ask the hard questions. Loyalty is earned, not given."
"She doesn't have to do a damn thing to earn our loyalty."
Murtaugh shook his head, his cowl swaying.
"For some of us, yes, but others might not be so easily convinced. She has 10 years to account for, and a kingdom in ruin."
"She was a child."
"She is a woman now, and has been for a few years. Perhaps she will offer an explanation. But until then, Adian, you must understand that others might not share your fervor, and others might take a good amount of convincing about you as well, about where your true loyalties lie, and how you have demonstrated them over the years."
He wanted to bash Murtaugh's teeth down his throat, if only because he was right.
"Who else of Orland's inner circle is still alive?"
Murtaugh named 4. Ren quickly added,
"We heard they were in hiding for years, always moving around like us. They might not be easy to find."
4.
Adian's stomach dropped.
"That's it?"
He'd been in Terrasen, but he'd never looked for an exact body count. Never wanted to know who made it through the bloodshed and slaughter, or who had sacrificed everything to get a child, a friend, a family member out. Of course, he'd known deep down, but there had always been some fool's hope that most were still alive, still waiting to return.
I'm sorry, Adian, Murtagh said softly. Some minor lords escaped, and even managed to hold on to their lands and keep them thriving.
Adian knew and hated most of them. Self-serving pigs. Murtagh went on.
Vernon Lochin survived, but only because he was already the king's puppet, and after Cal was executed, Vernon seized his brother's mantle as Lord of Peranth. You know what happened to Lady Marian, but we never learned what happened to Elead.
Elead? Lord Cal and Lady Marian's daughter and heir, almost a year younger than Aelin. If she were alive, she would be at least 17 by now.
Lots of children vanished in the initial weeks, Murtagh finished.
Adian didn't want to think about those two small graves. He had to look away for a moment, and even Wren stayed quiet. At last, Adian said,
Send out feelers to Ravi and Sol, but hold off on the others. Ignore the minor lords for now. Small steps.
To his surprise, Wren said,
Agreed.
For a heartbeat, their eyes met, and he knew that Wren felt what he often did, what he tried to keep buried. They had survived, when so many had not, and no one else could understand what it was like to bear it, unless they had lost as much. Wren had escaped at the cost of his parents' lives, and had lost his home, his title, his friends, and his kingdom. He had hidden and trained and never lost sight of his cause. They were not friends now. They never really had been. Wren's father hadn't particularly liked that Adian, not Wren, was favored to take the blood oath to Aelin. The oath of pure submission. The oath that would have sealed Adian as her lifelong protector. The one person in whom she could have absolute trust. Everything he possessed, everything he was, should have belonged to her. Yet the prize now was not just a blood oath, but a kingdom. A shot at vengeance and rebuilding their world. Adian made to walk away, but looked back. Just two cloaked figures. One hunched, the other tall and armed. The first shred of Aelin's court. The court he'd raise for her to shatter Otterlin's chains. He could keep playing the game. For a little longer. When she returns. Adian said quietly.
What she will do to the King of Otterlin will make the slaughtering 10 years ago look merciful.
And in his heart, Adian hoped he spoke true. Chapter 25. A week passed without any further attempts to skin Selena alive, so even though she made absolutely no progress with Rowan, she considered it to be a success. Rowan lived up to his word about her pulling double duty in the kitchens, the only upside of which was that she was so exhausted when she tumbled into bed that she did not remember dreaming. Another benefit, she supposed, was that while she was scrubbing the evening dishes, she could listen to Emrys's stories, which Luca begged for every night, regardless of rain. Despite what had happened with the skinwalkers, Selena was no closer to mastering her shift. Even though Rowan had offered his cloak that night beside the river, the next morning had brought them back to their usual vitriolic dislike. Hatred felt like a strong word, as she couldn't quite hate someone who saved her, but dislike fit pretty damn well. She didn't particularly care what side of the hatred-dislike line Rowan was on. But gaining his approval to enter Doranel was undoubtedly a long, long way off. Every day he brought her to the temple ruins, far enough away that if she did manage to shift and lost control of her magic in the process, she wouldn't incinerate anyone. Everything depended on that command. Shift. But the memory of what the magic had felt like as it seared out of her, when it threatened to swallow her and the whole world, plagued her, waking and asleep. It was almost as bad as the endless sitting. Now, after 2 miserable hours of it, she groaned and stood, stalking around the ruins. It was unusually sunny that day, making the pale stones seem to glow. In fact, she could have sworn that the whispered prayers of long-gone worshippers still resonated. Her magic had been flickering oddly in response. Strange, in her human form, where it was normally so bolted down. As she studied the ruins, she braced her hands on her hips, anything to keep from ripping out her hair.
What was this place, anyway?
Only slabs of broken stone remained to show where the temple had stood. A few oblong stones, pillars, were tossed about as if a hand had scattered them, and several stones grouped together indicated what had once been a road. Rowan dogged her steps, a thundercloud closing in around her as she examined a cluster of white stones.
The Sun Goddess's Temple.
Mala, Lady of Light, Learning, and Fire. You've been bringing me here because you think it might help with mastering my powers? My shifting? A vague nod. She put a hand on one of the massive stones. If she felt like admitting it, she could almost sense the echoes of the power that had dwelled here long ago, a delicious heat kissing its way up her neck, down her spine, as if some piece of that goddess were still curled up in the corner. It explained why today, in the sun, the temple felt different, why her magic was jumpy. Mala, Sun Goddess and Lightbringer, was sister and eternal rival to Diana, Keeper of the Moon. Mab was immortalized into godhood thanks to Maeve. Selena mused, as she ran a hand down the jagged block. But that was over 500 years ago. Mala had a sister in the moon long before Mab took her place.
Diana was the original sister's name, but you humans gave her some of Mab's traits. The hunting, the hounds.
Perhaps Diana and Mala weren't always rivals.
What are you getting at?
She shrugged and kept running her hands along the stone, feeling, breathing, smelling. Did you ever know Mab? Rowan was quiet for a long moment, contemplating the usefulness of telling her, no doubt.
No.
He said at last.
I am old, but not that old.
Fine, if he didn't want to give her an actual number. Do you feel old? He gazed into the distance.
I am still considered young by the standards of my kind.
It wasn't an answer. You said that you once campaigned in a kingdom that no longer exists. You've been off to war several times, it seems, and seen the world. That would leave its mark, age you on the inside.
Do you feel old?
His gaze was unflinching. A child,
a girl, he'd called her.
She was a girl to him. Even when she became an old woman, if she lived that long, she'd still be a child in comparison to his lifespan. Her mission depended upon his seeing her otherwise. But she still said, These days I'm very glad to be a mortal, and to only have to endure this life once. These days I don't envy you at all.
And before?
It was her turn to stare toward the horizon. I used to wish I had a chance to see it all, and hated that I never would. She could feel him forming a question, but she started moving again, examining the stones. As she dusted the block off, an image emerged of a stag with a glowing star between its antlers, so like the one in Terrasen. She'd heard Emrys tell the story of the sun stags, who held an immortal flame between their massive antlers, and who had once been stolen from a temple in this land. Is this where the stags were kept? Before this place was destroyed?
I don't know. This temple wasn't destroyed. It was abandoned when the Fae moved to Doranel, and then ruined by time and weather.
Emrys' story said destroyed, not abandoned.
Again, what are you getting at?
But she didn't know. Not yet. So she just shook her head and said, The Fae on my continent, in Terrasen, they weren't like you. At least, I don't remember them being that way. There weren't many, but...
She swallowed hard. The King of Otterlin hunted and killed them so easily.
Yet when I look at you,
I don't understand how he did it. Even with the word keys, the Fae had been stronger, faster. More should have survived, even if some had been trapped in their animal forms when magic vanished. She looked over her shoulder at him, one hand still pressed against the warm carving. A muscle flickered in Rowan's jaw before he said,
I've never been to your continent, but I heard that the Fae there were gentler, less aggressive, very few trained in combat, and they relied heavily on magic. Once magic was gone from your lands, many of them might not have known what to do against trained soldiers.
And yet Maeve wouldn't send aid.
The Fae of your continent long ago severed ties with Maeve.
He paused again.
But there were some in Doranel who argued in favor of helping. My queen wound up offering sanctuary to any who could make it here.
She didn't want to know more. Didn't want to know how many had made it, and whether he had been one of the few who argued to save their western brethren. So she moved away from the carving of the mythical stag, instantly cold as she severed contact with the delightful heat living within the stone. Part of her could have sworn that ancient, strange power was sad to see her go. The next day, Selena finished her breakfast shift in the kitchens, achy and more drained than usual, as Luca hadn't been there to help, which meant she'd spent the morning chopping, washing, and then running the food upstairs. Selena passed a sentry she'd marked as Luca's friend and a frequent listener to Emrys' stories. Young, leanly muscled, with no evidence of Fae ears or grace. Bass, the leader of the fortress scouts. Luca prattled about him endlessly. Selena gave him a small smile and nod. Bass blinked a few times, gave a tentative smile back, and sauntered on, probably to his watch on the wall. She frowned. She'd said a civilized hello to plenty of them by now, but... She was still puzzling over his reaction when she reached her room and shrugged on her jacket.
You're already late, Rowan said from the doorway.
There were extra dishes this morning, she said, rebraiding her hair as she turned to where he lounged in the doorway. Can I expect to do something useful with you today? Or will it be more sitting and growling and glaring? Or will I just wind up chopping wood for hours on end? He merely started into the hall and she followed, still braiding her hair. They passed another two sentries. This time she looked them both in the eye and smiled her greeting. Again, that blink, and a shared look between them, and a returned grin. Had she really become so unpleasant that a mere smile was surprising? Gods, when had she smiled last? At anyone or anything. They were well away from the fortress, headed south and up into the mountains, when Rowan said,
They've all been keeping their distance because of the scent you put out.
Excuse me?
She didn't want to know how he'd read her thoughts. Rowan stalked through the trees, not even out of breath, as he said,
There are more males than females here. And they're fairly isolated from the world. Haven't you wondered why they haven't approached you?
They stayed away because I smell? She didn't think she would have cared enough to be embarrassed, but her face was burning.
Your scent says that you don't want to be approached. The males smell it more than the females, and have been staying the hell away. They don't want to get their faces clawed off.
She had forgotten how primal the Fae were, with their scents and mating and territorial nature. Such a strange contrast to the civilized world beyond the wall of the mountains. Good, she wound up saying, though the idea of her having emotions so easily identifiable was unsettling. It made lying and pretending almost worthless. I'm not interested in men. Males. His tattoo was vivid in the dappled sunlight that streamed through the canopy as he stared pointedly at her ring.
What happens if you become queen? Will you refuse a potential alliance through marriage?
An invisible hand seemed to wrap around her throat. She had not let herself consider that possibility, because the weight of a crown and a throne were enough to make her feel like she was in a coffin. The thought of marrying like that, of someone else's body on hers, someone who was not Kaol. She shoved the thought away. Rowan was baiting her, as he always did, and she still had no plans to take up her uncle's throne. Her only plan was to do what she'd promised Nehemia. Nice try, she said. His canines gleamed as he smirked.
You're learning.
You get baited by me every now and then, too, you know. He gave her a look that said,
I let you bait me, in case you haven't noticed. I'm not some mortal fool.
She wanted to ask why, but being cordial with him, with anyone, was already odd enough. Where the hell are we going today? We never head west. The smirk vanished.
You want to do something useful. So here's your chance.
With Selena in her human form, the bells of some nearby town were heralding 3 o'clock by the time they reached the Pinewood. She didn't ask what they were doing here. He'd tell her if he wanted to. Slowing to a prowl, Rowan tracked markers left on trees and stones, and she quietly trailed him, thirsty and hungry and a bit lightheaded. The terrain had shifted. Pine needles crunched beneath her boots, and gulls, not songbirds, cried overhead. The sea had to be close. Selena groaned as a cool breeze kissed her sweaty face, scented with salt and fish and sun-warmed rock. It wasn't until Rowan halted by a stream that she noticed the reek and the silence. The ground had been churned up across the stream, the brush broken and trampled. But Rowan's attention was fixed on the stream itself, on what had been wedged between the rocks. Selena swore. A body, a woman by the shape of what was left of her, and a husk. As if she had been drained of life, of substance. No wounds, no lacerations or signs of harm, save for a trickle of dried blood from her nose and ears. Her skin was leached of color, withered and dried, her hollowed-out face still stuck in an expression of horror and sorrow. And the smell. Not just the rotting body, but around it. The smell. What did this? She asked, studying the disturbed forest beyond the stream. Rowan knelt as he examined the remains. Why not just dump her in the sea? Leaving her in a stream seems idiotic. They left tracks, too. Unless those are from whoever found her.
Malachi gave me the report this morning, and he and his men are trained not to leave tracks. But this scent, I'll admit it's different.
Rowan walked into the water. She wanted to tell him to stop, but he kept studying the remains from above, then below, circling. His eyes flashed to hers. They were furious.
So you tell me, assassin. You wanted to be useful.
She bristled at the tone, but
That was a woman lying there, broken like a doll. Selena didn't particularly want to smell anything on the remains, but she sniffed and wished she hadn't. It was a smell she'd scented twice now, once in that bloody chamber a decade ago, and then recently.
"You claimed you didn't know what that thing in the barrow field was," she managed to say.
The woman's mouth was open in a scream, her teeth brown and cracked below the dried nosebleed. Selena touched her own nose and winced.
"I think this is what it does."
Rowan braced his hands on his hips, sniffing again, turning in the stream. He scanned Selena, then the body.
"You came out of that darkness looking as if someone had sucked the life from you. Your skin was a shade paler, your freckles gone."
"It forced me to go through memories.
The worst kind."
The woman's horrified, sorrowful face gaped up at the canopy.
"Have you ever heard of a creature that can feed on such things? When I glimpsed it, I saw a man, a beautiful man, pale and dark-haired, with eyes of full black. He wasn't human. I mean, he looked it, but his eyes, they weren't human at all."
Her parents had been assassinated. She'd seen the wounds, but the smell in their room had been so similar. She shook her head as if to clear it, to shake the creeping feeling moving up her spine.
"Even my queen doesn't know every foul creature roaming these lands. If the skinwalkers are venturing down from the mountains, perhaps other things are too."
"The townspeople might know something. Maybe they've seen it or heard rumors."
Rowan seemed to be thinking the same thing, because he shook his head in disgust. And sorrow, to her surprise.
"We don't have the time. You wasted daylight by coming here in your human form."
They hadn't brought any overnight supplies, either.
"We have an hour before we head back. Make the most of it."
The path led absolutely nowhere. It ran into a sea cliff with no way to the narrow strip of beach below. No sign of anyone living nearby. Rowan stood at the cliff's edge, arms crossed as he stared out at the jade sea.
"It doesn't make sense," he said,
more to himself than to her.
"This is the fourth body in the last few weeks. None of them reported missing."
He squatted on the sandy ground and drew a rough line in the dirt with a tattooed finger, the shape of Wendland's coastline.
"They've been found here."
Little dots, seemingly random save for being close to the water.
"We're here,"
he said, making another dot. He sat back on his heels as Selene appeared at the crude map.
"And yet you and I encountered the creature lurking amongst the barrow whites here,"
he added, and drew an X where she assumed the mounds were, deep inland.
"I haven't seen any further signs of it remaining by the barrows, and the whites have returned to their usual habits."
"Were the other bodies the same?"
"All were drained like this, with expressions of terror on their faces. Not a hint of a wound, beyond dried blood at the nose and ears."
From the way his tan skin paled beneath his tattoo, the way he gritted his teeth, she knew that it rankled his immortal pride not to know what this thing was.
"All dumped in the forest, not the sea?"
A nod. "But all within walking distance of the water." Another nod.
"If it were a skilled, sentient killer, it would hide the bodies better. Or again, use the sea."
She gazed to the blinding water, the sun starting its afternoon descent.
"Or maybe it doesn't care. Maybe it wants us to know what it's doing. There were times when I left bodies so that they'd be found by a certain person, or to send a type of message,
Grave being the latest of them. What do the victims have in common?
I don't know,
he admitted.
We don't even know their names or where they came from.
He rose and dusted his hands off.
We need to return to the fortress.
She grabbed his elbow. Wait. Have you seen enough of the body? A slow nod. Good. So had she. And she'd had enough of the smell, too. She'd committed it to memory, noting everything that she could. Then we've got to bury her.
The ground's too hard here.
She stalked through the trees, leaving him behind. Then we'll do it the ancient way, she called. She'd be damned if she left that woman's body decomposing in a stream. Damned if she left her there for all eternity, wet and cold. Selena pulled the too light body out of the stream, laying it on the brown pine needles. Rowan didn't say anything as she gathered kindling and branches, and then knelt, trying not to look at the shriveled skin or the expression of lingering horror. Neither did he mock her for the few times it took to get the fire started by hand, or make any snide comments once the pine needles finally crinkled and smoked. Ancient incense for a rudimentary pyre. Instead, as she stepped from the rising flames, she felt him come to tower behind her, felt the surety and half-wildness of him wrap around her like a phantom body. A warm breeze licked at her hair, her face. Air to help the fire, wind that helped consume the corpse. The loathing she felt had nothing to do with her vow or Nehemia. Selena reached into the ageless pit inside her. Just once, to see if she could pull up whatever trigger it was that caused the shift, so she could help her sad little fire burn more evenly, more proudly. Yet Selena remained stale and empty, stranded in her mortal body. Still, Rowan didn't say anything about it, and his wind fed the flames enough to make quick work of the body, burning far faster than a mortal pyre. They watched in silence, until there was nothing but ashes, until even those were carried up and away, over the trees, and toward the open sea.
Chapter 26 Kaol hadn't seen or heard from the general or the prince since that night in the tomb. According to his men, the prince was spending his time in the healer's catacombs, courting one of the young women down there. He hated himself, but some part of him was relieved to hear it. At least Dorian was talking to someone. The rift with Dorian was worth it. For Dorian, even if his friend never forgave him. For Selena, even if she never came back. Even if he wished she were still Selena and not Aelin. It was worth it. It was a week before he had time to meet with Adian again, to get the information that he hadn't received thanks to Dorian interrupting them. If Dorian had snuck up on them so easily, then the tomb wasn't the best place to meet. There was one place, however, where they could gather with minimal risk. Selena had left it to him in her will, along with the address. The secret apartment above the warehouse was untouched, though someone had taken the time to cover the ornate furniture. Pulling the sheets off one by one was like uncovering a bit more of who Selena had been before in Dovier, proof that her lavish tastes ran deep. She'd bought this place, she'd once told him, to have somewhere to call her own. A place outside the Assassin's Keep where she'd been raised. She'd dropped almost every copper she had into it, but it had been necessary, she said, for the bit of freedom it had granted her. He could have left the sheets on, probably should have, but he was curious. The apartment consisted of two bedrooms with their own bathing rooms, a kitchen, and a great room in which a deep cushioned couch sprawled before a carved marble fireplace, accented by two oversized velvet armchairs. The other half of the room was occupied by an oak dining table capable of seating 8, its place settings still laid out. Plates of porcelain and silver, flatware that had long since gone dull. It was the only evidence that this apartment had been untouched since whoever, Aerobin Hommel, probably, had ordered the place sealed up. Aerobin Hommel, the king of the assassins. Kaol gritted his teeth as he finished stuffing the last of the white sheets into the hallway closet. He'd been thinking a good deal about Selena's old master in the past few days. Aerobin was smart enough to have put things together when he found a washed-up orphan right after the Princess of Terrasen went missing. Her body vanished into the half-frozen Florine River. If Aerobin had known and done those things to her... The scar on Selena's wrist flashed before him. He'd made her break her own hand. There must have been countless other brutalities that Selena didn't even tell him about. And the worst of them. The absolute worst. He'd never asked Selena why, when she was appointed champion. Her first priority wasn't hunting down her master and cutting him into pieces for what he'd done to her lover, Sam Cortland. Aerobin had ordered Sam tortured and killed, and then devised a trap for Selena that got her hauled off to Endovir. Aerobin must have expected to retrieve her someday, if he'd left this apartment untouched. He must have wanted to let her rot in Endovir, until he decided to free her and she crawled back to him, his eternally loyal servant. It was her right, Kaol told himself. Her right to decide when and how to kill Aerobin. It was Adian's right, too. Even the two lords of Terrasen had more of a claim on Aerobin's head than he did. But if Kaol ever saw him, he wasn't sure he would be able to restrain himself. The rickety wooden staircase beyond the front door groaned, and Kaol had his sword drawn in a heartbeat. Then there was a low, two-note whistle, and he relaxed just slightly and whistled back. He kept his sword drawn until Adian strode through the door, sword out.
I was wondering whether you'd be here alone or with a gaggle of men waiting in the shadows,
Adian said by way of greeting, sheathing his sword. Kaol glared at him.
Likewise.
Adian moved farther into the apartment, the fierceness on his face shifting among wariness, wonder, and sorrow. And it occurred to Kaol that this apartment was the first time Adian was seeing a piece of his lost cousin. These were her things. She had selected everything, from the figurines atop the mantle, to the green napkins, to the old farm table in the kitchen, flecked and marred by what seemed like countless knives. Adian paused in the center of the room, scanning everything. Perhaps to see if there were indeed any hidden forces lying in wait. But... Kaol muttered something about using the bathing room and gave Adian the privacy he needed. This was her apartment. Whether she accepted or hated her past... She decorated the dining table in Terrasen's royal colors, green and silver. The table and the stag figurine atop the mantle were the only shreds of proof that she might remember, might care. Everything else was comfortable, tasteful, as if the apartment were for lounging and nights by the fire. And there were so many books, on shelves, on the tables by the couch, stacked beside the large armchair before the curtained floor-to-ceiling window spanning the entire length of the great room. Smart, educated, cultured, if the knick-knacks were any indication. There were things from across the kingdoms, as if she'd picked up something everywhere she went. The room was a map of her adventures, a map of a whole different person. Aelin had lived. She'd lived and seen and done things. The kitchen was small but cozy, and, gods, she had a cooling box. The captain had mentioned her being notorious as an assassin, but he hadn't mentioned that she was rich. All that blood money, all these things just proof of what she'd lost, what he'd failed to protect. She'd become a killer. A damned good one if this apartment was any indication. Her bedroom was even more outrageous. It had a massive four-poster bed with a mattress that looked like a cloud, and an attached marble-tiled bathing room that possessed its own plumbing system. Well, her closet hadn't changed. His cousin had always loved pretty clothes. Adian pulled out a deep blue tunic, gold embroidery around the lapels and buttons glimmering in the light from the sconces. These were clothes for a woman's body, and the scent still clinging to the entire apartment belonged to a woman. So similar to what he remembered from childhood, but wrapped in mystery and secret smiles. It was impossible for his fey senses not to notice, to react. Adian leaned against the wall of the dressing room, staring at the gowns and the displays of jewelry, now coated in dust. He didn't let himself care about what had been done to him in the past, the people he'd ruined, the battlefields he'd walked off covered in blood and gore that wasn't his own. As far as he was concerned, he'd lost everything the day Aelin died. He had deserved the punishment for how badly he'd failed. But Aelin... Adian ran his hands through his hair before stepping into the great room. Aelin would come back from Wendlin, no matter what the captain believed. Aelin would come back, and when she did... With every breath, Adian felt that lingering scent wrapping tighter around his heart and soul. When she came back, he was never letting her go. Adian sank onto one of the armchairs before the fire, as Kaol said,
"Well, I think I've waited long enough to hear what you have to say about magic. I hope it's worthwhile."
"Regardless of what I know, magic shouldn't be your main plan of defense or action."
"I saw your queen cleave the earth in two with her power," Kaol said. "Tell me that wouldn't turn the tide on a battlefield. Tell me that you wouldn't need that, and others like her."
"She won't be anywhere near those battlefields,"
Adian snarled softly. Kaol highly doubted that that was true, but wished it was. Adian would probably have to bind Selena to her throne to keep her from fighting on the front lines with her people.
"Just tell me."
Adian sighed and gazed at the fire, as if beholding a distant horizon.
"The burnings and executions had already started by the time magic disappeared. So the day it happened, I thought the birds were just fleeing the soldiers or looking for carrion. I was locked in one of the tower rooms by the king's orders. Most days I didn't dare look out the window, because I didn't want to see what was happening in the city below. But there was such noise from the birds that day that I looked. And..."
Adian shook his head.
"Something sent them all flying up in one direction. Then another. And then the screaming started. I heard some people just died right on the spot, as if an artery had been cut."
Adian spread out a map on the low table between them and put a calloused finger on Orinth.
"There were two waves of birds. The first went north-northwest."
He traced a vague line.
"From the tower, I could see far enough that I knew many of them had come from the south. Most of the birds near us didn't move much. But then the second wave shoved all of them to the north and east, like something from the center of the land threw them that way."
Kaol pointed to Perenth, the second largest city in Terrasen.
"From here?" "Farther south."
Adian knocked Kaol's hand out of the way.
"And Dovier, or even lower. You couldn't have seen that far."
No, but the warrior lords of my court made me memorize the birds in Oakwald, and all their calls for hunting, and fighting. And there were birds flying up toward us that were only found in your country. I was counting them to distract myself while...
Another pause, as if Adian hadn't meant to say that.
I don't remember hearing any birds from the three southern kingdoms.
Kaol made a rough line, starting in Rifthold and going out toward the mountains, toward the Farian Gap.
Like something shot out in this direction.
It wasn't until the second wave that magic stopped. Adian raised a brow.
Don't you remember that day? I was here. If anyone felt pain, they hid it. Magic's been illegal in Otterlin for decades. So where does all this get us, Adian?
Well, Murtagh and Wren had similar experiences. So then the general launched into another tale. Like Adian, Wren and Murtagh had experienced a frenzy of local animals, and twin waves of something the day magic had disappeared. But they'd been in the southern part of their continent, having just arrived in Skull's Bay. It wasn't until 6 months ago, when they'd been lured into the city by Archer Finn's lies about Aelin's reemergence, that they'd started considering magic, contemplating ways to break the king's power for their queen. After comparing notes with the other rebels in Rifthold, they realized that others had experienced similar phenomena. Wanting to get a full account, they'd found a merchant from the deserted peninsula who was willing to talk. A man from Xandria who was surprisingly honest, despite the business he'd built on contraband items. I stole an Asterian mare from the Lord of Xandria. Of course Selena had been to the deserted peninsula and sought out trouble. Despite the ache in his chest, Kaol smiled at the memory, as Adian recalled Murtagh's report of the merchant's account. Not two waves when magic vanished in the desert, but three. The first swept down from the north. The merchant had been with the Lord of Xandria in his fortress high above the city, and had seen a faint tremor that made the red sand dance. The second came from the southwest, barreling right toward them like a sandstorm. The final pulse came from the same inland source Adian remembered. Seconds later, magic was gone, and people were screaming in the streets, and the Lord of Xandria got the order, a week later, to put down all the known or registered magic wielders in his city. Then the screaming had become different. Adian gave him a sly grin as he finished. But Murtagh figured out more. We're meeting in 3 days. He can tell you his theories then. Kaol started from his chair.
That's it? That's all you know? What you've been lording over me these past few weeks?
There's still more for you to tell me, so why should I tell you everything?
I've told you vital, world-changing information, Kaol said through his teeth. You've just told me stories.
Adian's eyes took on a lethal glint. You'll want to hear what Wren and Murtagh have to say. Kaol didn't feel like waiting so long to hear it, but there were two state lunches and one formal dinner before then, and he was expected to attend all of them, and present the king with his defense plans for all the events as well. After a moment, Adian said,
How do you stand working for him? How do you pretend you don't know what that bastard is doing? What he's done to innocent people? To the woman you claim to love? I'm doing what I have to do.
He didn't think Adian would understand anyway.
Tell me why the captain of the guard, a lord of Otterlin, is helping his enemy. That's all the information I want from you today.
Kaol wanted to say that, given how much he'd already told him, he didn't have to offer a damn thing. Instead, he said,
I grew up being told we were bringing peace and civilization to the continent. What I've seen recently
has made me realize how much of it is a lie.
You knew about the labor camps, though. About the massacres.
It is easy to be lied to when you do not know any of those people firsthand.
But Selena with her scars, and Nehemia with her people butchered.
It's easy to believe when your king tells you that the people in Endovir deserve to be there, because they're criminals or rebels who tried to slaughter innocent Otterlanian families.
And how many of your countrymen would stand against your king if they too learned the truth? If they stopped to consider what it would be like if it were their family, their village being enslaved or murdered? How many would stand if they knew what power their prince possessed? If their prince rose up to fight with us?
Kaol didn't know. And he wasn't sure he wanted to. As for Dorian, he could not ask that of his friend. Could not expect it. His goal was keeping Dorian safe. Even if it would cost him their friendship, he didn't want Dorian involved. Ever.
The past week had been terrifying and wonderful for Dorian. Terrifying because two more people knew his secret, and because he walked such a fine line when it came to controlling his magic, which seemed more volatile with each passing day. Wonderful because every afternoon, he visited the forgotten workroom Sorsha had discovered. Tucked in a lower level of the catacombs where no one would find them, she brought books from the gods' new ware, herbs and plants, and salts and powders, and every day they researched and trained and pondered. There weren't many books about dampening a power like his. Many had been burned, she'd told him. But she looked at the magic like a disease. If she could find the right channels to block, she could keep it contained. And if not, she always said, they could resort to drugging him, just enough to even out his moods. She didn't like the idea of it, and neither did he, though it was a comfort to know the option was there. An hour each day was all they could manage together. For that hour, regardless of the laws they were breaking, Dorian felt like himself again. Not twisted and reeling and stumbling through the dark, but grounded. Calm. No matter what he told Sorsha, she never judged or betrayed him. Kaol had been that person once. Yet now, when it came to his magic, he could still see fear and a hint of disgust in Kaol's eyes.
Did you know, Sorsha said from her spot across the work table, that before magic vanished, they had to find special ways of subduing gifted prisoners?
Dorian looked up from his book, a useless tome on garden remedies. Before magic vanished, at the hand of his father and his word keys. His stomach turned.
Because they'd use their magic to break out of prison?
Sorsha studied the book again. That's why a lot of the old prisons use solid iron. It's immune to magic.
I know,
he said. And she raised a brow. She was slowly starting to come alive around him,
though he'd also learned to read her subtle expressions better. Back when my power first appeared, I tried using it on an iron door, and it didn't go well. Sorsha chewed on her lip. It was surprisingly distracting.
But iron's in your blood, so how does that work?
I think it was the gods' way of keeping us from growing too powerful. If we keep contact with the magic, if it's flowing through us for too long, we faint. Or worse.
I wonder what would happen if we increased the iron in your diet. Perhaps adding a large amount of treacle to your food. We give it to anemic patients, but if we gave you a highly concentrated dose, it would taste awful and could be dangerous, but...
But perhaps if it's in my body, then when the magic rises up...
He grimaced.
He might have balked at the memory of the agony when he'd tried to seal that iron door, but he couldn't bring himself to say no to her.
Do you have any here? Just something to add to a drink?
She didn't, but she got